episode of Gamers Footnotes with two S's, and our website, as always, is gamersfootnotes.com, and as you can see, we're now on iTunes, so welcome all Apple users. We'll try not to berate you and badmouth you too much.
Right.
I am JT, joined along with my co-host, Steven.
Yes, hello everyone.
And in this episode, we're going to talk a little bit about some things that gamers accept that normal people or other people won't accept. And Steven's going to talk a little bit about, in his short segment, about the integration of social media, specifically relating to MMOs. And I'm going to talk about something that's near and dear to everybody's heart, which is how to actually deliver an effective apology, especially when you're not actually sorry. And our email address is gamersfootnotes with two S's at gmail.com. So we do let Google read all of our information, and we feel like that's very appropriate. So anybody at Google or NSA or out there in the greater world wide web have any ideas for our show, feel free to let us know, and we're happy to talk about whatever y'all would like to hear. So, and segueing to our main episode and talking about some things that gamers will accept that other people won't, I think one of the natural places is gamers have a very strong sense of evolution on how games have evolved from A to B. So even starting as something basic like Doom, gamers have accepted to hunt around a place to find the right color key to unlock a door. And that's a very basic thing that most people don't accept.
And nor would they. I mean, in some sense, you've got giant guns and things like that. There's a point in almost every action game where I think, why don't you just shoot the door? I can solve this problem. But we accept that you can't because it would be game-breaking. Literally, you would be breaking the game. And we don't want that. And so I think a lot of it just derives from kind of the simple idea that we want to play the game. We want to be a part of the game. We want to engage in the mechanics. And so, much like there's a suspension of disbelief, which is a common concept in especially movies, is where you hear it come up. And I think really in games, just as games are sort of movies plus some extra components, the suspension of belief necessarily has to account for those extra components.
And even getting further into the suspension of disbelief, one of the big things to me is having to beat the boss three times. And that's a gaming trope that goes all the way back to some of the earliest NES games, that we expect things to occur in rounds of three. And we get upset if things don't occur in rounds of numbers of three. I mean, it's a very numerical number that we actually look forward to in games, whereas most people are like, why did you have to do that three times in a row? And we don't have a good answer. We're just like, because you do. And that's how it's always been.
Because that's how much life the boss has. I'm reminded of having to jump on various turtles in Mario three times. Like, well, why didn't the first two work? And the reason is because, well, that might be too easy. And so we wanted you to have to do it three times to see if you could repeat your feat of getting on top of that turtle. And so, again, it's one of those things that I think people don't think about. And the reason we don't think about it is the whole nature of the suspension of disbelief is you're not supposed to think about it. You're supposed to just accept that that's what's going on. But for anyone who's ever tried to explain gaming to a significant other or to a family member, these are things that someone who's not initiated or someone who's not invested in the game maybe like, well, why did that happen? And that's not to say they'll pick it up pretty quickly. I mean, it's pretty intuitive as to why that would be if you think about it. But the trick is, we generally don't think about it.
Not at all. And a lot of it, especially in action games, is we'll understand motivations behind the characters far more than other people will. I had a conversation with somebody who's not really a gamer and has only played a few games. And they're like, well, I like the games where I kill zombies. And I'm like, that's not very helpful to me because there are a lot of different games where you kill zombies. And there's a lot of different ways to kill zombies. Are you talking about a shooter game? Are you talking about Left 4 Dead type game? Are you talking about an alt mode for Call of Duty? Are you talking about some of the new zombie games where they're much more into survival? Are you talking about a Last of Us kind of style game? I mean, there are a lot of different ways to kill zombies that just saying I like games where I kill zombies means, now it means nothing to me, but means everything to them.
Right, because we as gamers tend to accept a whole different lexicon, a whole different way of speaking about games, and part of that is the natural evolution we talked about with games becoming more and more like art, invariably to discuss art, you have to have sort of a language develop to discuss the nuances of games, because, you know, the devil is in the proverbial details. And as that happened, you developed people who spoke that language and were very invested in that aspect of games. And then you have people who kind of maybe come in a little bit more, I am determined not to use the word casually here, but a little bit without that language, without that investment. Nothing wrong with that. You know, it's just approach the game sort of as its own experience. And if they don't have that language, then it very quickly separates out into an issue where you can't really talk on the same level about the game. It's like that with books and with movies. You can talk about a movie having just seen it, but you're probably not going to be able to talk about it the same way as, you know, a film buff who wants to discuss cinematography and knows the history of different film styles. They're going to have different words that they're going to use to talk about that film because they're going to have been approaching it in a different way. Games have simply reached that point. And so in the sense that someone who is more invested is a gamer, if we want to use that as the rotating carousel of definitions for gamer, sort of ephemeral concept, then in this case, a gamer would be someone who had the language to discuss these things, and that's something that a gamer will accept that someone else won't, is that very need for that additional language, for those ways to talk about the thing they enjoy.
And the one thing you're really starting to see, sort of this rise between gamers and, to use the word Steven doesn't want to, casual gamers, is in a lot of phone games, iOS and Android games. So take, for instance, Angry Birds. There's a lot of casual people who play Angry Birds, which is why it sold a quadrillion copies. But how long did it take those people to realize that to get 3 stars, you can only use one bird? Whereas regular gamers can look at this, see you have 5 birds, see that it's a physics puzzle, and you're like, yes, to get 3 stars, I need to figure out how to hit this with one bird, and I know the solution is not going to be obvious on its face. And that's sort of in a lot of casual games, why gamers get frustrated with them for something like Angry Birds. And I'm not saying that I like Angry Birds. I don't know Steven's thoughts on Angry Birds.
I like Star Wars Angry Birds.
Star Wars Angry Birds is very good, but we enjoy it in a much different level than I think a lot of casual gamers do, who just enjoy having it as a way to pass time. But we get down into the, this is an evolution of a puzzles game. This is an evolution of a physics simulator. We understand that, to use Angry Birds Star Wars, that the Obi-Wan Blackbird, who uses the Force to push things, you're going to have to shoot him someplace and then probably push the blocks backwards the opposite way in order to collapse the system. But we're already looking for that upon picking up the game, whereas a lot of casual people are just trying to kill the pigs.
Right, and I guess my anecdotal example of that is old game on Yahoo, Poppet. I would play that on a phone or something when I was waiting for a bus or things like that. My mom actually owned the game for a PC and would sit there and play it on the PC. And that's sort of, to me, the difference is that it would never have occurred to me to own Poppet for the PC, nor would it ever have even occurred to me to play it when I was sitting at home capable of doing other things. It's a gap filler. And the reason I don't want to say just a gap filler, I had a lot of fun with it. It was great for what it did. But the reason it functioned as a gap filler for me is, again, I was looking at it purely as this is basically an iteration of the color-based, it's really Tetris. It's a different form of Tetris at the end of the day. And how do I arrange the pieces so that I can fit the equivalent of lines? Here they're short lines, so that the balloons burst. You know, you're looking at it as a system. That's not to say I'm any good at it, I'm not. But even though I'm not great at it, I know what I'm looking at is a color-based systemic representation of, and what you're trying to do is move the individual pieces around to form the blocks. In Tetris, you were given the blocks and you were trying to form the shape. In this, you're given more granular blocks and you're trying to turn them into something else. It all ends up being the same thing. It's not that, you know, gamers are naturally going to be a lot better at these things. It's that they are going to approach them from the perspective of a puzzle game, from the perspective of an evolved form of an earlier game, even if it's subconsciously, than they are as a game, as a diversion in its own right.
And that sort of nicely segues into RPGs, which have a much different view from a gamer's perspective than I think from a casual perspective, in the sense that when you've played enough RPGs, you accept the fact that grind's going to exist, and that you might have to slay 250 slime in order to learn a specific skill, in order to then unlock something else, which will then unlock something else, which you will then be able to use against the final boss, as something we expect to have in a game. But that's patently absurd, because it's not something that should be in the... It's not something that's like in Monopoly. There's no secret way to win at Monopoly. I mean, other than just gross total warfare and attrition in Monopoly. But as a gamer, we would look at... We would design Monopoly and be like, okay, so how can I get a hotel cheaper? How can I go unlock a skill that allows me to steal somebody's property? This is the things that we're looking at. Like, it makes sense to us that I need to spend 80 hours breeding chocobos so I can get the special black chocobo to then go get Knights of the Round in order to beat a specific sub-boss, which has nothing to do with the plot.
Well, that's just it. And when those challenges don't exist, you'll find that people will create challenges. Seeing how, I know Final Fantasy XII, a big one was, how low a level can I be and beat the game? Because the progression system was actually based on license points. It was this whole other thing. Your level controlled sort of other, controlled, I believe, a certain amount of statistics and then health. And so the challenge was, but of course you got experience automatically from certain boss fights and things that were unavoidable in the story. And so the challenge was, what is the lowest level I can be and beat the game? And, of course, the game didn't ask you to do that. The game didn't give you anything for doing that, really. And so, even when the challenge wasn't there, even when it wasn't even just mildly unrelated, it was completely unrelated, it was fan-generated, it still happened. And that's not going to make... That doesn't even necessarily make sense to all gamers. It's certainly not going... So, you intentionally made this much, much harder just because. And part of what that stems from is, well, yeah, but it's cool to see how far I can get and to see what I can do and to see if I can use one game system but ignore another game system. That's interesting. That's entertaining. That's fun. That's a different experience. That's an experience I want to have. There are reasons it would happen, but those aren't necessarily satisfactory reasons if you aren't invested heavily in why those systems came about in the first place. You accept the leveling system on face value because it's, again, of course it has a leveling system. And that's where the difference comes in. Is because you've accepted the leveling system, you accept that using aspects of it, not aspects, creates a challenge, which is interesting, which is fun. But if you didn't accept the initial premise that there needed to be a leveling system in the first place, nothing downstream works. And so that initial assumption ends up being kind of the foundational assumption for how we approach a lot of games, especially RPGs, altogether.
And that sort of leads into the what I think is the pinnacle of things gamers accept that non-gamers don't, and that's theory crafting. And I know that's a holdover from tabletop games, and that's been around for forever, but that's really come into its own, and especially modern gaming, is non-gamers don't understand how you can have 40-hour weeks where you don't play the game, but you play on how to make the skills work together in order to then theoretically play the game more efficiently. They don't understand, like, why aren't you spending that time playing the game? Well, I can already play the game. I need to play the game and be better at it, and this is how I get better at it. And I mean, I think a lot of MMOs work on that, and it's such a odd concept that I think a lot of developers struggle with why this is happening or how to prevent it from happening. Or how to make it happen. I think a lot of developers look at this and just are like, I don't understand.
Well, and I, even outside of MMOs, I mean, who hasn't sat around trying to figure out exactly what stat allocation in the special system was necessary to have the right Fallout character? Now, I resist that to a certain extent, because especially for those open-ended games, you should, a lot of times it's, again, fun to sort of mess with the system, see, well, what can I do with a character with two intelligence? Obviously, this is not the optimal way to do things, but that can be entertaining. At the same time, though, there is, I think, this impulse in the back of, at least in my mind, it says, yes, but what's the right character? Okay, what's the character that's going to be able to go out there and do everything? And a lot of times the Fallout games are structured in such a way to prevent you from doing that, but to prevent you from doing everything. and that enhances replayability, and there are reasons that would happen. But in MMOs, you see all the time, it's like, well, your character's not set up right. You know, you've designed your character wrong. And that has to do with min-maxing and, again, theory crafting, of course. But the whole system, again, is predicated on this idea that there is a right way to do things, and that the right way to do things has nothing to do with what you think is right. It's what we can provably demonstrate is right, and that it all comes down to numbers. And that's another aspect that you're going to be asking a lot from someone to even understand why that would be a thing. You can explain it simply as, well, I want to win, and this is the best way to win. But when the victory conditions are ill-defined or achievable from multiple routes, the Fallout games, or even MMOs, where, okay, do you really care about the extra 10 DPS when we're talking about 100,000 DPS total? You're not going to be able to explain why people would obsess over something that ultimately, if they're very honest with themselves, doesn't make any difference. It makes a difference to them, though, because it demonstrates commitment and the ability to understand the technical aspects of the game. And so it's not even really about the ability to win or do better. People will say it is. But if you actually get right down to it, since that doesn't make sense, you kind of have to go for a secondary reason. And I think the most obvious secondary reason is it shows commitment. It's a way to demonstrate expertise within the game, even when it doesn't actually make any difference.
And that gets to a good point. I mean, most activities, sports, for instance, people want to show mastery. And people show mastery through feats of great skill. And in a lot of games, it's hard to show feats of great skill because games are designed to be beaten. I mean, there's a path to get from the beginning to the end in most modern games. I mean, that's not true in a lot of old school arcade games, which were just designed to basically you play until you get broken or
Pitfall.
Yeah. I mean, that's why kill screens were invented. Like, we didn't know that, like, games don't end. Like, the machine will just run out of memory before you actually get to the end. But in most modern games, they're designed, especially games as most modern games are designed to tell a story, is they're designed for you to travel from the beginning to the end. So it's hard to show your mastery by simply beating the game nowadays. So a lot of people have to show their mastery by beating the game in such a way that they understand how to break it, that they understand everything you can do and everything you can't do. And my favorite thing is to read the forums and just go into the threads where people are flaming each other for having the, quote, right build for whatever the task at hand is. And I think a lot of casual people look at MMOs and are like, well, I want the purple armor. And a gamer would be like, I don't understand what you're telling me. You need the armor that has this, 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 and this. And then more casual people are like, but that armor's ugly. And we're like, I don't understand what you're trying to tell me.
I actually remember, and if he's listening to this show, he'll laugh. A friend of mine, when we were in high school, Might and Magic 6, they're re-releasing the old school Might and Magic game, Might and Magic 10, but Might and Magic 6, many, many years ago, he had gotten his armor together, and I said, well, that's, what are you doing? This is like, oh, well, you know, I wanted I like this armor set, it looks cool. And I remember kind of just staring slack-jawed and going, why? Who cares? It's not the best armor. You need this. You know, this is all better stuff. Why would you do this to yourself? So that's in MMOs. That's a natural evolution from old party based. People forget there before there were MMOs. You controlled the whole party yourself. In the Might and Magic games and related genre staples, and it was a thing there too. Like, you would have people who'd come in like, oh, well, this looks cool and I want to use this. Like, no, that's wrong. You are wrong. You need to be doing this to work with the system and to beat the system. And maybe that's another potential definition of gamer, is how you approach the system. Do you view the system as the game board or as the opponent? But it all comes down to, some people are just not going to accept, like, well, why do you care if I reach the same end result? Then it doesn't make any difference what my armor looks like.
And I think Steven hit the nail on the head. Gamers approach games as being systems, as there are rules and there are ways to get around some of the rules. What rules can be bent, which rules can be outright broken, which rules are immutable. I mean, even going back to Doom, people figured out how to walk through walls. I mean, it's not... That's the desire of gamers, is to figure out the entire system, looking at the game as being its own microcosmic, you know, type of system of which there are variables and the parameters, and figuring out where the confines are. Where a lot of people that aren't quite there yet in their gaming still look at it as, well, let's just have fun.
Right. And God knows games aren't about fun. No, it. I think it's... there are, obviously, and we've kind of joked about this, but just to say explicitly, there are myriad definitions for gamers. It kind of means what you need it to mean to explore the concept. And so I would say that there is certainly a subset of gamers that I would call system gamers that are really looking at, are really approaching the experience not from the aspect of, let me back up a little bit. Gamers also wear a lot of different hats. Because, of course, we spent a bunch of episodes early on talking about art. And sometimes you're not necessarily looking at the game just as a system at that point. You're looking at it as an artistic work, which is still a system, but you may be sort of looking at it as looking at a whole unit without ignoring the or without looking directly at specific systems. And in other times, you may look at very specific systems. And perhaps my third for the day, definition of gamer is someone who will look at games from kind of different perspectives, taking different pieces and things like that, because it's that sort of engagement that's going to cause you to have the lexicon, that's going to cause you to think about these things, that's going to drive you to get that 1% DPS increase when you're already capable of beating every encounter in the game. Those kinds of things are going to happen at that point. And maybe that's what makes you a gamer. So, you know, it's a concept. Please, if you have your own definition of gamer, let us know. gamersfootnotes@gmail.com. That's what I'm looking for. And angry emails can go there.
And I think another thing to sort of explore, Stephen talks about, is looking at story. A lot of people look at cutscenes as being the only thing that conveys the story, especially non-gamers, as being the only thing to convey the story of a video game. Whereas we understand all of those parts where you're grinding through the different parts of it are still telling the same story. So even taking that out of the RPG and just looking at a game like Wing Commander, that large chunks of the stories are told between missions in cutscenes. So whether it's Wing Commander 1 or 2, where it's, you know, hand-drawn computer characters just talking to you, or 3 and 4 where it's actually movie scenes, or some of Prophecies, which is also movies, and then some of the add-ons, Secret Ops, which is just text in between the missions, that a lot of people see that, well, that's when it's conveying the story. Except when you play enough games, you realize all the time in between the cutscenes is part of the story, too. That it's helping to enlighten the narrative, that, you know, when you're killing 60 wolves for their livers, that that's actually helping a wolf infestation problem, which furthers the plot. And I think it's seeing the grind as being part of the story is something that's unique to gamers that a lot of non-gamers don't necessarily see.
Right, and I think just to use our kind of go-to example for the podcast in situations like this, I'm going to look at The Last of Us. It has movie cutscenes, and they're important. They're really not that much of the story. You're really, while you're out there sneaking around and doing things, that's the story, because ultimately the game is about survival and what that means and the psychology of survival, and you get a better sense of that while you're out there attempting to survive and failing to survive, and that's again something that would be very enjoyable for maybe someone to just, if you turned The Last of Us into a movie, it would probably be enjoyed by a lot of people who don't like video games, but I also maintain it would be a completely different experience. And the reason is reason for that is very simple. You're not going to get those visceral reactions. You're not going to get the investment of you trying to get your character to safety and it being you pushing them. You're not an observer anymore. You're actually an agent. And that is going to make it a very different experience. And so a gamer, someone who's not familiar with games might not accept that as well. They might say, oh, well, I'll just watch you play the cutscenes, or I'm just trying to get to the next cutscene. And in doing so, they will make it a movie experience rather than a game experience. And it's the fact that gamers do accept that you need to have these mechanics, you need to be able to do these things, and I need to pay attention to them, that creates this this different experience. And that's what that's where the difference lies, is in the ability to engage with these extra components that will change the experience.
And I think you can look at also taking that further, a game like Professor Layton, where it's basically just 100 logic puzzles that are barely tangentially related to the plot. And then flowing out cutscenes kind of sewing in the narrative together is a lot of times people who like those style of games, people like me, people like others, well, they don't even question why you're doing the puzzles. It's not like, why is this person asking me these logic riddles? It's more like, okay, this is what this game is about. This is the challenge of it. And this sort of helps unlock what my character's doing, what I'm supposed to be doing, what I'm supposed to be thinking. That in taking Professor Layton, it shows that Layton wants to help people by solving these problems. That it's not a... He takes them at face value, which helps... Which allows gamers to then, in turn, take it at face value and sort of move forward. Whereas, how do you explain a game like that to somebody else? Like, what I want you to do is watch a cutscene, and then you need to solve 20 riddles, and then you get another cutscene. I mean, it sounds absurd. But it is a lot of fun because it's engrossing in a way. It's a way in which you can look at the world differently.
And being able to look at it differently, or maybe it's not necessarily being able, it's, again, I think it's having the experience to understand why you would need to look at this differently or to subconsciously accept these things. That's what drives the difference in the experience. Anyone can experience some aspect of the game, but to really get involved, especially in modern games now that we've had decades of previous material to kind of ground the medium, you need some of that experience to get in. And it'll be interesting, I actually, to kind of watch people growing up now over the next several years, because they've, of course, always had video games. And not just, I don't mean they've always existed, they've always, you know, especially with the advent of mobile devices and Angry Birds. I mean, my 4-year-old nephew plays Angry Birds. It will have always been there. And so you say, well, so why will they be able to enjoy games? Because they won't have, well, no, they will have the history. They'll just approach the history from a different starting point. And it'll be interesting to see how that drives the evolution of games, as with a different kind of background from tomorrow's players, I would almost expect that they'll accept things that maybe we didn't accept originally. And that will drive the evolution of perhaps further different experiences in gaming.
And I think you see a lot of that on the mobile platform in freemium games. That it's a whole model that older gamers are just constantly rebelling against, because we understand that a freemium game works because you're going to make the mechanics in such a way that in order to progress in a timely manner, we will need to continue to hand you money. And that's why we rebel against freemium games. Whereas newer, younger gamers may not view it that way. They may just see it as, well, I have 2 hours to play. Paying a dollar or two for 2 hours of entertainment is worth it. I mean, it's a whole different acceptance of what the situation is. Whereas older gamers who are used to having 90-hour Final Fantasy games are like, I expect to get 90 hours out of whatever money I hand you, and I don't expect to hand you more money.
Exactly. And it'll be fascinating to find out exactly how that turns. But it all, I guess one point to raise is tomorrow's gamers may be using a different lexicon than we do. So I don't exempt anyone from the possibility of being on kind of the outside, from being the non-gamer in this situation.
I think Steven brings up a great point. I think there's a point where even he and I will become non-gamers, that the nature of any kind of art is it always evolves past you. I mean, it falls past beyond what your philosophical understanding it is. And you can see even some of this today in the DuckTales Remastered Remake. I played through it, and it has been so long since I played NES games that it almost crushed me with how difficult, like how painstakingly difficult it was. But, you know, I managed to go back and use those old muscles again and get through it, but it was a lot of fun. But you can almost see the splits in reviews and people on the forums where some people were like, this is how I remember it. This is how games should be. And other people that were in part of my French, what the hell is this? Like, I don't understand why I keep dying. Well, that's how NES games work. They were 2 hours worth of game content, and they made it longer by forcing you to die over and over again until you got good enough to then beat the game.
Exactly. And so, you know, if your definition of gamer revolves around being able to interact with the correct language and things like that, there is always the possibility that at one point you will wake up and you will realize you don't have the language for a certain game. You can even find that to a certain extent. It is harder for me to discuss intelligently certain genres because I'm not interested in them. And so it's not a matter of intelligence or even skill necessarily. It's a matter of what are you interested in? How much do you want to put into it? And so another possible definition of gamer is someone who wants to put in the time to be able to discuss a particular game or the medium in general. And so there's no specific shame in not being a gamer. Well, there is, but you wouldn't be listening to this podcast if that were an issue for you. But there is sort of, it's a flexible definition, and it can change person to person, maybe even day to day. And the key to understanding it is that the only real downside to not being a gamer is that you are going to approach the experience differently, and so you may have trouble interacting with someone who is going to take it to kind of that next level. Same as you would with movies, same as you do with books. Everyone has that friend who can't just enjoy a book. They have to discuss the greater sociopolitical implications of that book. I am that friend. So
that's what Steven and I have in common.
Exactly. And so it's why our conversations are interesting and maddening. But you are going to have to deal with that. And similar to games, there are books that I just don't care about, and people say, "Oh, well, yes, but you see, sparkly vampires are a metaphor for the inability to hide one's true nature." And, you know, I might take a swing at you. I might not. Point is, just as with gamers and non-gamers, we're going to interact with the Twilight books. Some people believe they're books. I believe they're fuel.
Fahrenheit 451 agrees with you.
Exactly. Wonderful book. People should take it more seriously in the case of Twilight. Moving sort of far afield, but it does demonstrate a point. People are going to interact with media differently. And so if you have to talk to someone about your favorite game and they're not going to have the same kind of vocabulary as you, you're going to encounter some difficulties. It's not impossible, but if you kind of think back through it and think, well, I'm approaching this as a system, as a series of events that are interrelated that made sense because I made these assumptions. If I didn't have those assumptions, what would I think of the game? And that may give you a greater insight into kind of how to talk about games to someone who's not as interested as you are.
And I think the one last little point I want to address in that, especially because we're now seeing it in iOS games, is, the like as Steven said, viewing it as a system, viewing it as different paradigms stacked upon each other with different lenses in order to perceive reality. I play this game called Trivi, which is basically a fancy trivia game with a couple of people who aren't gamers. And so Trivi whacked its players with the Nerf bat. So here's what happened. It's a freemium game, and you earn a coin for every answer you give. There's 30 questions, so you can earn up to 30 coins. Then you earn 5 coins for losing and 10 coins for winning. So you can win a maximum of 40 coins and a minimum of 5 coins. And they then basically make money because you pay coins to then pick the trivia categories to stump your friends with. And when they initially wrote the game, they had a random trivia category for 2 coins. So you were always guaranteed at least a 3-coin profit if you picked the 2-coin system. So when I saw this, I was like, this will eventually get nerfed. Because there's no way to make money on a freemium game if I can always guarantee myself a profit of 3 to 37 coins. And lo and behold, they eventually realized that people gravitated towards picking the random trivia questions and always getting the profit, and they patched it out. They patched out the random trivia. So now everybody started losing coins because that's how a freemium game works. You have to set the trivia categories. I think they set them at 20, 25, and 30, which if your maximum you can get is 40 for getting everything right, you're not going to make enough profit to then buy a category again. Because you can only make, at a most, if you pick the 30 category, 10 coins. So now you're already in the whole 10 coins for the next time. And basically, the little Apple reviews blew up when this happened because people didn't understand what happened. But as gamers, we're like, yeah, there was a hole in the system. Clearly, this is going to get nerfed. And I think that's a thing that non-gamers don't really understand, is the interaction between game players and developers and developers need to make money. We understand that it's a job for them, and this is for them to make money. Whereas casual gamers don't have that level of interactivity. They don't see Parker Brothers selling Monopoly as a way to make money. They just see it as, here's a game, I've handed you one-time amount of money. It's not a continuing revenue stream. So, I mean, that's kind of the interesting thing to me is you see things that have happened in the past then start carrying over into the casual gaming market, such as nerfing, exploitation, profit streams. I mean, these are all old hat to us, but you have a bunch of new users who are like, I have no clue what's happening to me. Why am I unjustly upset about the loss of something?
Piracy. I've had more and more people ask, so how do you get this? I'm like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, I don't want to pay for it, but I want to get it. I'm like, you want to steal it? No, I just want it without paying for it. I'm like, yeah, well, that's okay. Don't say that at the hearing. But
it's patch day.
Exactly. And so you start to see more and more of that. But I think that's an excellent segue, because I'm curious, have they commented on that? Have they apologized at all for the confusion that patching that out caused?
It was pretty funny, because I actually emailed them because this was a point of contention. And so I emailed the people, and I was like, in my email, I basically said, look, the random trivia, your fan base likes it because they like to have the random questions across different platforms, because that's fun in and of itself. And the solution is not removing random trivia from the game. The solution is pricing random trivia to a point where you think you will still make money even if people pick it. So in the next patch, which occurred a week and a half later, was to put random trivia back in at 25 coins, which I think is where they figure the maximum break-even point is. So that if you play a random trivia game, they expect you to make 0 coins off of that. So, and I think ultimately that that's sort of like a win-win solution, but it kind of raises a separate point, is a lot of developers are gamers, and they would have come to that conclusion as the way to initially nerf it. They just would have raised the price of the coins and been done with it. Mm-hmm. But a lot of iOS developers aren't necessarily gamers per se. They're just people who see this as an opportunity to make money with whatever their passion is. So they were completely confused on why people were outraged about what happened, and like, why you can't just swing the nerf bat as hard as you can and hit people. So, and I think that sort of brings me back into what I've seen starting with trivia is, how do you effectively apologize when you're not really sorry? And I have basically three examples of things that I thought ended up kind of working, but were not as effective as they could be. The first one is, we'll start with this trivia game. The game's called Trivia, and it's a trivia game, so that's super confusing. And their solution for their apology was to say nothing and just patch it in. That is a valid tack to take a lot of times, is not to justify your actions if you're a developer, because you've done what you did for a reason, and oftentimes the reason why you did it is not pleasant. It's not something that you really want people to do, and in this case it was because we weren't making money off of you. And there's no good effective way to issue an apology that's like, we were not effectively exploiting you, so therefore we apologize for any inconvenience we might have caused you. But the problem you have, especially in a platform like the iOS, is people don't always patch their games. I mean, it's not like an MMO where the launcher forces a patch upon you and you can fix it. So sometimes you do actually have to release a statement and say something to the effect of, well, we've heard your concerns, and we agree with you that this random trivia category was something we want back in the game, and we've put it back in. I'm always a big fan of telling the truth, which is bad for a lot of different reasons, and often not the optimal answer. But a lot of time, the ire of the gaming community can be avoided if you just tell them the truth. Because a lot of times they'll figure it out. And then you just look stupid hiding the truth, because we all know the answer, and it's a giant white elephant in the room, and that just breeds distrust. Which leads me to my second apology, which is MechWarrior Online, which released a third-person point of view into the game, which then, as Steven just winced, immediately destroyed the forums and started like a 200-page post thread about why PGI should die in a fire and, you know, maybe murder all of their relatives going back into, you know, 0 BC. And part of the problem is they know that the third-person mode was not going to be favored by hardcore players. So when they initially announced that they were going to do this, one of the things they said was is they were going to make separate queues for first-person players only and then third-person players. And that didn't make it into the patch when it went on the live server because the fundamental problem is there's not enough players in the game to split the community in half. And so then PGI attempted an apology, but their apology was sort of like a... It wasn't a bad apology because they basically said they were sorry, but it lacks sincerity because they don't engage in communication. If you know you're going to do something that's going to upset a great deal of people who... And gamers, we have to understand that sometimes we are too vocal and sometimes we are ridiculous. And basically, people were destroying them on Facebook, onto Twitter, on their forums, on everywhere. People were demanding refunds. I mean, it was scorched earth policy 101. But the problem with the apology in itself is worthless without a valid explanation of why this happened. And the answer is simply, Battletech's hard to understand if you haven't played a Battletech game. I mean, Steven and I have played a lot of them, so we understand the mech's upper body moves separately than its lower body, and we can look on the mini-map and see this is how you orientate your feet, this is how you orientate your arms, this is how you move across the map, and after a match or two, it becomes second nature. But if you're picking up a Battletech game for the first time ever, it's super confusing. I mean, none of it makes sense. All the rules are arbitrary. Mechs don't move in a way that's natural. It's not anything we have any natural experience with. It's not like a racing game where you can just say, this makes my car go faster and this turns left and this turns right. That's something we all intuitively understand. A mech is not like a car. And so PGI is probably right. You do need to have a third-person mode to allow new players of the game to understand how a mech moves. Now, have they implemented it the best way possible? No. But that needed to be the forefront explanation. It's the thing everybody in the forums knows it's true. You're trying to get new players because there are not enough hardcore Battletech fans to sustain the franchise. But if you would lead with that and not be apologetic about that fact, but say, look, this is the facts, this is our solution, people either will accept it or they won't accept it, but you won't have this contention of people thinking that you're lying to them.
And, now to strike a blow for the side of dishonesty, you do have to be careful with your apologies because what we're seeing with Final Fantasy XIV ongoing during the MMO launch, and since it is an MMO launch, it is not going well. They keep apologizing. And the problem is when you say, we're really sorry, but we fixed it, and then it goes down again a couple hours later and you say, we're really sorry about that, but this time we've got it, and then the same errors occur and we're sorry. Part of this is a cross-cultural thing. There are some reasons that a Japanese company is likely to produce formal apologies for each instance of an issue. But pretending I don't know anything about that. You gotta be careful about apologizing and giving people information and saying, oh yeah, no, this is what happened and we fixed it, when you don't know if you've actually fixed it, because that works once, maybe twice, but everything after that is just going to cause people to say, you don't know what's going on. And now no matter what you say, you have a problem. So there is such a thing as too much apology.
And I agree with that, but let me even step this further. Like, what if Square Enix had come out and just simply said, look, we understand that this game keeps crashing. We think it has to do with the way the login server is negotiating back in with the game server, and it can't sustain this many connections. And we think we have two different ways to solve it, and we think the first thing should work. I mean, and if the first thing doesn't work, you at least know that they are trying something, and you know where the problem is. I mean, it's human nature to fail repeatedly. I mean, I think that's one of the things that gets lost in game making is game devs aren't perfect. People aren't perfect. Humanity is about failure. The game of baseball, you fail 70% of the time. And people think you're great at it.
Yeah.
So the average is to fail 75% of the time And that considers you to be an average player at a major league level. So, I mean, failure is something that humans understand intuitively. And I think if game devs would apologize in a way that didn't make it seem like they want... Game devs want to be seen as all-knowing and all-powerful. And if they would drop that facade and more of their communications, I think things would go better because people would feel more ingrained into it, which sort of leads me into the third apology that I've seen recently, which was with Star Citizen, which was such an effective apology, Steven didn't even realize there was an apology. And this had to do with the miscommunication of when the Hangar module was going to launch versus launching on Saturday at 2 p.m. our time versus launching next Thursday. And, you know, there was some confusion, and they're in Germany, and the forums went ablaze for a little bit, and it kind of got leaked that the launch got pushed back in a PC gamer German version. So then the article was in German, and then it had to be translated into Babelfish, and then this occurred right on the heels of MechWarrior announcing the third-person point of view, of which Star Citizen and MechWarrior shockingly have a large overlap of player bases, and people thought that Star Citizen was trying to hide something. And Chris Roberts released a very nice statement from the chairman explaining the situation, explaining what's going on. And that's one of the things I like about Star Citizen is they don't apologize in the sense of asking for forgiveness. They apologize by, these are the facts, these are the decisions we're making, so be it. Another big fight you see in the Star Citizen's forums is about the limited ships, which they one time said were going to only be for a limited period, but now they have, to the surprise of nobody, decided that they may re-release the limited ships closer to the end of November to eke out the last little bit of sales that they can. I personally don't have a problem with that because this makes sense to me. This would be what I would do in their situation. They've done a good job of sort of releasing statements of like, look, we haven't even said we're going to do this, but we might do this, and accept that this is how it's going to be. And I think if you're very matter-of-fact about this is the situation, this is our proposed solution, this is where we're going to go forward, that is a much better tack than the superficial, I'm sorry, we fixed it, when, as Steven said, oftentimes you don't know whether you fixed it or not. Star Trek Online suffers from that a lot, that the game is fundamentally broken, their engine's fundamentally broken, they can't really make a better Star Trek game with what they have. And for a long time, they were honest about it, like, we know it's broken, and we are attempting to fix it, bear with us. Now it's just become a blatant cash grab and is annoying, but they were at least honest through that process, so it's not as upsetting as other things.
And I did. The Star Citizen, I didn't realize it was an apology because it basically, I didn't know about this controversy. I tend to avoid beta forums for a variety of good reasons. But so I didn't know about the, like, oh, well, okay, it was coming out. It's coming out Thursday. It's 4 days. Who cares? I forgot about it. And so when I read Mr. Roberts' statement, it was basically, oh, well, you know, we appreciate you guys. This is great. We want you to be involved in the process. I've never really done anything like this before, and, you know, so, and then here's the plan. I didn't really realize there had been any controversy because I didn't read it. So I thought, oh, well, that was, I remember thinking it was worded a little weird, like, huh, it's got a kind of an odd tone to it, but whatever, it's, you know, it's coming out Thursday, great, moving on. And I think that was very effective. I think they've done a good job of managing expectations, and much to the irritation of the forum population, I think they've done a good job of explaining to everyone what the role of the community is, which is not to be the game developer. In the subscriber forum for Star Citizen, they'll frequently ask questions or say, hey, we're thinking about this, what do you think? And it's not that they don't ask for feedback, but there's never been any real confusion that while they're interested in the feedback, they're making the decisions, and maybe they're asking, maybe they're not. But as appreciative as they are of the player base and their crowdfunding, this is a game that they're developing that we're going to play, and there is a line between those two points. I think that's very important, because it is like anything else. Too many cooks, you're going to spoil the broth. And here, you know, and on apologies, that can go a long way towards, you know, crafting your apology in such a way that reinforces... we're sorry there was a misunderstanding. though you should never say that because that's not an apology, but you know, we're there, here is the plan, here is the official information, this is the decision that's been made, we hope you are happy about the decision, but with the undertone of, and if you're not, that's kind of more your problem than ours. And I think that's what your apologies need to communicate, is we're working on it, we're fixing it, and if it doesn't work out, then your option is to kind of go somewhere else, and if enough people go somewhere else, we'll be destroyed. So obviously we don't want you to do that, but we've made the decision, here it is.
Right, and I think fundamentally that when game developers issue apologies to the community, we need to understand that we're all and essentially have the same devil's bargain. They want to make a game that we want to play. We want them to make a game that we want to play. There's really no point in apologizing because we're all on the same train going in the same direction. They just need to tell us why the train's stopping at the various depots.
And one way they might be able to tell us that is through the integration of social media into games. I think that was a smooth segue. I enjoyed that.
Super smooth.
I don't think anyone noticed. So recently I've been seeing a trend, and social media is a big deal, and obviously we're seeing it more and more, but talking less about just putting a Twitter icon on your page, which absolutely everyone, including law firms, does now, actual social media sites. And what do I mean by that? Again, obviously pretty involved in Final Fantasy XIV, and with their relaunch of the Lodestone, their player server, you have the kind of the traditional, for people who are familiar with World of Warcraft and the Armory system, a page you can go to see your character and their gear. And they've gone a step further, and you can post blog entries, and you can follow other characters, and they're attempting to create a social media site for their game. My, and I think a lot of people's initial reaction was to rebel against that, because I don't want a social media site. The game is the social media site. I will go talk to people there. But I've tried to take a step back and, you know, kind of look at this from the view of kind of taking it fresh rather than my kind of preconceptions on social media or the word social in general, since I am a nerd. And there are some interesting implications from what they're doing. Because they really can create sort of a, we always talk about community. Well, this can be another tool for dealing with community, dealing with organization. Battle.net tried to do it. I don't have a great feel for how successful it was, because frankly, I don't use the Armory that much. And I don't think I'll use Lodestone that much in Final Fantasy XIV. But when you have these kind of big companies, Square Enix, Activision Blizzard, making these decisions, you start to think that maybe this isn't just bandwagoning, like, oh, well, Facebook's successful, we want to be successful too. Maybe they really are thinking we need to create a more integrated community. And one of the advantages that could have, I think, is maybe spreading out or even alleviating sort of the toxic nature of forums. Oftentimes, forums become cesspools. They just do. The people who are involved on forums are obviously people who are interested in the game as a unit, but are so interested that they needn't be playing the game to discuss the game. The more integration you have between the social aspects of the game and the communication methods, I think the more likely you are to have a kind of a broader group of players and maybe temper the passions that are so common to forums. I lurk on forums all the time, so this is not a criticism of people who are on forums, but they tend to be of a certain type of person, and a new player can get a grossly skewed view of the game itself if they go and try to extrapolate what the player base is based on the forums. You are not seeing the player base, you are seeing the forum base. And so some of this integration might actually help with that. You might see a broader cross-section through the community sites that then, the more you encourage everyone to sort of be involved in the discussion, the more temperate is a better word, the discussion may become. I don't know if that'll work. And the reason I don't know if that'll work is ultimately you're still asking people to engage with the game outside of the game. And I don't know how much people do that. And it's not just MMOs. We see it with Maxis too. EA through Maxis, through the Sims launcher, they've tried to create sort of a forum. And because that's a game that involves a lot of modding, a lot of player-created content,
which they nerfed.
Yes, which they've screwed up. But that aside, that sort of aided that community because there was something to talk about. There was, oh, well, I designed this, I designed that, you know, that kind of thing. And so I could sort of see it there. In MMOs, I'm not as sure, because ideally the robust tools for community building are inside the game. Do you really need them outside the game? The reason it's working right now with Final Fantasy is that you can't actually get into the game. So, you know, that this way you can talk about it while the servers are exploding all over themselves. But... so that's been a benefit of the downtime that people aren't talking about. It's encouraging the use of their social media side. So ultimately, I even when I try to approach it kind of fresh, kind of without my general irritation about social media sites and kind of the bandwagoning of, oh, everyone needs to have a Twitter link on their website, whether they have anything useful to say or not. I don't know that it'll be successful, because I just don't know how much interest there is in playing the game outside the game. But I can think of ways that it could enhance the experience if you get sort of more, a larger cross-section of the player base kind of involved in these original social media sites.
And I'll play devil's advocate on this one, and I'll take the opposite tack, whereas I think all of these are examples of astroturfing. And astroturfing, for those of you who don't know, is more seen in the political field, where corporate entities, entrenched entities, political parties attempt to create fake grassroots efforts in order to control the narrative. And when Steven asks, he's not sure how effective people want to play the game outside the game is. I think they do, and I think you've seen that throughout the internet almost exploded because of people wanting to talk about games outside the games. You see almost every large game series has some kind of fan page where people talk about the lore, where people talk about the game, where people talk about how to play the game, the quote, unofficial forum. So for Guild Wars, you had Guild Wars Guru. You had the unofficial Guild Wars Wiki. You have similar things for World of Warcraft. You have a whole website that existed for 15 years about Wing Commander called the CIC. And the person who ran that now works for Star Citizen. So you see that there's these fan groups that have created unofficial fan forums. SimCity is a good one. Age of Empires and the mod community for that has done the same thing, where people talk about the lore, people talk about the games, people talk about modding, people want to share their experience, because humans are inherently beings that wish to connect with others. I mean, that's sort of the human condition, is that we need the love of others. I mean, No Exit is the existential book that says hell is other people, because what we crave for other people, they may not want to give us. There are exceptions, which Steven will always point out, of true loners, true outsiders, but that's the exception and not the rule. And I think a lot of game companies look at social media and want to basically engage in astroturfing, which is to convert these grassroots movements they know will exist into their own set of servers where they can then control the message. And they want to prevent people from starting the grassroots and just sucking them into the forums right away, because they know these people will exist. And like a vacuum cleaner, they want to suck them in and basically tie them together. Well, I mean, that may not have a lot of allure for a lot of different people, but it sort of annoys me, because I look at it far more cynically, where game developers want to get into the social media, this creative community, because they want to, A, monetize it, and B, if they can't monetize it, they want to engage in massive amounts of censorship.
And we'll see. That may end up being what happens. So far, this may simply be because they'd never get away with it, but there has not been much censorship of the thousands and thousands and thousands of posts that essentially amount to, I hate Square Enix, why in the name of God can they not get their servers to run? But again, if they were censoring that, it would be pretty obvious that they were doing it. And so it could very easily be about message control. I do think that there's a lot of truth to the idea that, well, if we can get people involved here, they won't go elsewhere. I believe that's what they want. I don't believe that it will work particularly effectively, because especially with MMOs, they do have fan created content. Ultimately, if you allow mods of any, UI mods. If you allow those of any kind, which the plan is for this too, and for World of Warcraft, you're always going to have sites that deal with that, because they're not going, Square Enix isn't going to want to host any of that. And necessarily, I mean, that's ultimately one of Curse's biggest things, perhaps why it is as big as it is now, is that they hosted all of these add-ons. Add-on was the word I was looking for, or phrase I was looking for. And that's, I know they existed before that and they do other things, but that really helped in that they were capable of being basically the repository of add-ons for World of Warcraft. And so I think those sites will continue to exist, but the idea of message control is an interesting one. It may be a big part of the idea behind it, and it will probably encounter some success. They will get some people, but I think with any game where there's ultimately fan-created content, you're not going to get all, you're not going to fool all of the people all of the time.
And that is going to be what we're going to talk about next week. And that's how you do a proper segue, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, join us for our next episode when we talk about fan patches and how they interact with games, how they interact with some of the concepts we've talked about, and why, personally, they've saved certain games that should have been in the scrap heap of oblivion. And I'm really looking forward to talking about that and making Steven download all kinds of fan patches.
Right, and I am looking forward to cleansing malware off of my computer for 3 weeks afterwards. But as always, Gamers Footnotes, two S's. You can find us at gamersfootnotes@gmail.com. And I'm Steven.
And I'm JT. And thank you for joining us for this episode. And look forward to seeing you next episode.